Sir David King came out of Africa some decades ago, becoming Professor of Chemistry at Cambridge, then the UK's chief scientist, and he's now Director of the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at Oxford. They were set up over 2 years ago. So what's been achieved so far?
I think the most important achievement is that we have become known to the point where we can advise governments. And I suppose the work that we're most pleased with is the work that we're doing in Africa, where we are working on low-carbon economic development plans for countries. The most successful in Rwanda, where the Rwandan president invited us in. We had 8 people working in-country for 9 months, each of them working with a minister of government in the minister's office and the program director in the president's office. So at the end of it, there's complete buy-in of everything we're recommending, demonstrating that low-carbon development is good in an underdeveloped country. So it's counterintuitive.
Yes, I must say that I would have thought they'd be very leery of that and want tried and tested stuff rather than new and questionable.
Rwanda is a very good example because they are landlocked. Every drop of oil that they use has to come into the nearest port and then be brought by big lorries overland into the country. Extremely expensive. And at the same time, as oil prices go up, whereas the global GDP is hit by 0.2% for every 10% rise in oil price, in Rwanda it's much, much bigger than that. So the impact on their economic growth is very big. So showing them a path that removes oil dependency as their economy grows is very clearly economically viable. But a second one is, of course, most of their product is agriculture. They export tea and coffee. And we are demonstrating that with local manufacture of a mix of compost, manure and chemical fertilizers, instead of just wholesale chemical fertilizers, you improve the soil, you improve the productivity, and you massively lower your import costs. So there are many, many win-win situations.
That seems to be fairly low-tech. Are they going in for any 21st century high-tech solutions?
Yes, leapfrogging into the future is what it's about. Like every other African country, they have seen the massive advantages of mobile phone technology. And we are simply saying, let's have a look at airships and what that can do for the transport of people and goods around Africa without local infrastructure. You don't need long stretches of expensive railway lines and roads by transporting things using airships. Now, are airships modern technology? The Hindenburg goes back quite a few years. But we are talking about modern airships with modern design capacity, which is transformational.
Who's making them now?
Well, we're talking to companies like Rolls-Royce in Britain. There are several manufacturers around. Believe it or not, Hindenburg still exists. But there's nobody who has achieved a market breakthrough. My own belief is that Australia and Africa are typical of regions where the breakthrough could be enormous. Relatively large distances where the expense of putting in local infrastructure is enormous and maintaining it. It will be transformational in Africa, of that I'm sure. Airships, the lift is free. They are lighter than air. And translational motion requires engines. But you can carry fuel, you can carry large weights in an airship, and you can deliver to the ground at any point. It's a skyhook. The advantages are simply massive.
What if you're in a hurry?
If you're in a hurry, you travel in an airship at around 140 kilometres an hour compared with a Boeing doing 850 kilometres an hour. So it is travelling considerably slower. If you're talking about distances of 1,000 kilometres and you're saving local travel because goods are being delivered exactly where you want them, you can actually shorten time as well. So we have examined the case of moving tomatoes from Spain to Britain. Now, instead of having to deliver, as currently happens with a wide-belly Boeing, into Heathrow and Gatwick, and then deliver by train to the ultimate destination, what about delivering straight to the supermarket roofs? Right? You cut off all of the middle problems. You actually save time and massively save money.
And there won't be a traffic jam in the air.
There won't be a traffic jam in the air, and I just want to emphasise that you've saved an awful lot of carbon dioxide emissions.
Yes, indeed. When it comes to conventional planes, the name of the game now is biofuels, and in fact 3 years ago planes started to use them, and where we come from, algae are being used to produce this sort of oil. You've looked into that. What's the assessment of the efficiency?
What we've done is a full life cycle analysis of algae oil and other ways of producing biofuel. And a life cycle analysis means that you're looking at cradle to grave, taking the plant, watering it, fertilizing it. And by the way, fertilizer is very energy intensive in its production. Seawater can be used, so that's great. Not much land use. It's very, very good on land use. You're not displacing foodstuffs, which is very important. But it turns out that in the process of producing diesel from algae oil, drying the algae and so on, you're using 3 to 3.5 times as much energy in the production than the energy in the fuel that you've produced. Now, by working hard on this, you can actually reduce the energy cost and you can also reduce the carbon footprint very substantially. But there's an important bottom line. You need to go to a country like France where electricity is produced by nuclear energy because the electricity itself is then zero carbon. If you use electricity in Australia, for example, where you're heavily coal dependent, then your algae oil, I'm afraid, is going to have a high carbon footprint.
So it's not yet a panacea?
It's not yet a panacea, so we've got to watch out for double counting. Yes. When you burn algae oil, you're putting carbon dioxide back into the air that the algae plant used while it was growing. But don't ignore the rest of the process.
Now, I've got a map produced from one of your studies which shows the world in terms of how well they're performing regarding carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions. And the first thing I look at is, of course, Australia, which is not very poor. But it is poor, and it is rather like Canada and North America. The thing that really staggers me is that the rest of the world, the developing world, and the whole of Europe looks bloody good. How come?
So what has happened is European Union, following Kyoto, introduced an emissions trading process, and that is well underway. At the meeting in Copenhagen, there was no agreement on how to take Kyoto forward. That was very largely because the United States, followed by Canada, Japan, and dare I say Australia, decided that they couldn't support a continuation of Kyoto. But Obama led an alternative process which delivered the Copenhagen Accord, and at Cancun that became adopted by all countries, including Australia. And that is a voluntary process in which country by country, each country is asked to declare how they will reduce their emissions. So you've now got countries like Indonesia showing up the rest of the world. Indonesia are now on a pathway to reduce their emissions by 26% by 2020. This is quite astonishing. What is a developing world doing? South Africa is on an even stronger pathway than Indonesia.
Where you come from.
Where I come from, and I'm very proud of that. And Brazil, you'll see Brazil is one of the best behaved countries.
Well, this is staggering because both Indonesia and Brazil burn their forests, clear their forests in a way that's almost breathtaking. It is breathtaking.
Yes, and of course that is where they come in with a big advantage, because we are counting the annual deforestation that occurs as part of the CO2 emissions from that country. So as they move into avoided deforestation, they deliver a massive reduction from their country in terms of CO2 emissions.
And Indonesia's doing that?
Indonesia's doing that. I would say Indonesia, one of the best behaved. I mean, alongside China, and I just want to say about China, the reforestation that is occurring in China in the Les Plateaux region, that's a region the size of France, is simply staggering. It's much more than the rest of the world put together. They have already reforested an area of desert land, high rainfall desert land. They've reforested an area the size of Belgium, and they have promised, and I believe them, that by 2020 they will have reforested the whole of the Loess Plateau, an area the size of France. This is simply mind-staggering. So the reason why we're rating China high is not only because of reforestation. They are now the country producing more photovoltaics than any other country, more wind turbines. They have now gone strongly over into renewables. They're going into renewables and reforestation because it has a direct impact on clean air in China. They're going down this route so that they can manage to reduce their dependence on fossil fuels, both for economic reasons and to be good players, I hope, on the climate change agenda.
Well, this is very interesting because going back to Australia, rated poor on this chart, not very poor, I say we've gone up a notch, partly because of the carbon price, I infer. And the debate in Australia is all about whether we should go out on our own before anyone else has done so, and what this does to you. Does it make you vulnerable? From what you're saying, we're not out on our own.
I think there's a severe misunderstanding that defossilizing is going to be a cost to your economy. I believe that Europe is going to see a stimulus to its economic growth from the investment in these new low-carbon technologies. In other words, whenever a technological revolution takes place, we see a boost to the economy. This happened in the 1990s with the development of the e-economy. And I do believe there's very clear evidence, for example, from South Korea, where the investment in green technologies is really moving quickly, that the advantages start accruing even quicker. So the idea that investing in new technology is somehow going to harm your economy is very strange. We could go on burning coal, and isn't that going to be cheaper?
Well, ours is almost free, it's so cheap.
Yes, so you scratch the ground you're walking on and you find there's coal down there. That is true. But at the same time, you're kind of missing the boat if the new high technologies that come through are available around the world, but not in Australia. And these high technologies, let's face it, are all far cleaner, far better for us. It's not just CO2 emissions. So burning coal creates all sorts of problems. Now, for much of the world, there isn't a lot of fossil fuel around. And there's no doubt the benefits are greater in these new technologies for those countries without fossil fuel, because at the moment they're having to import. But I think Australia has to import a lot of oil. And any country that is a net importer of oil suffers from a knock on the GDP. So if you can decouple your economic growth from oil dependence, your quid's in, unless you are a net oil exporting country.
Given the fact that most countries, to some extent including Australia because of the deficit, are finding far less money to invest, do you think there would be sufficient funds to make a difference in terms of developing these new technologies in time?
Well, that of course is a very important question. The funds are there. The question is, what are people investing their money in? I haven't checked the gold price today, but I do know that 5 years ago, it was about $650 an ounce. And we were now up to about $1,800 an ounce as a result of the financial downturn. Putting money into gold is about the most unproductive thing to do with money. So all this is about is not a shortage of money, it's about creating confidence in our economies so that those people who are currently putting it into gold will see there are far better opportunities in the new technologies and manufacturing sector that will emerge from it.
Sir David King, former UK chief scientist, he's now director of the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at Oxford. Next week on The Science Show, you can catch up on this year's Nobel Prizes. And by the way, the Ig Nobels are already online, with Australia scoring magnificently, not least with the effect of a full bladder, as I now have, on human behaviour. On The Science Show next time, I shall talk to the son of two Australian Cambridge professors, Dr. Julian Huppert, MP. I'm Robin Williams.